So good evening and welcome to Kadampa Center. I've been getting a lot of questions about the practice booklets. So in case this is all new to you, Venerable Ravina has been referring to some materials. One of them is her course notes that she's provided, which are available for free on the back table. There's a whole stack. Annie is our Vanna White for the evening. You're welcome to take a copy of it. I've also sent out an email with links to it so you can download it if you prefer to download rather than have a print version. And I'm going to resend those out since there have been so many questions about it. So there's a second link that I'll resend out, and this is through our official Kadampa Center e-list. So if you're not on that, go to our website, contact us. There's a Yahoo group sign-up information, and you'll find out about all our activities, all these announcements that are being made all the time. It's really useful to be on that. So the other one is called Daily Meditation by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's our spiritual director of the FPMT. And he has just released this booklet that's his advice for a morning practice. It's got mantras and a meditation and prayers. And so Venerable Ravina read from it last Saturday morning. She may or may not read from it again this Saturday morning. We'll have some printed copies available for the Saturday morning portion of the workshop, and anybody who would like to take one of those tomorrow is welcome to have a copy of it. And then again, I'll be sending out that link so that you can download it as a PDF. It's something that you normally would have to buy for a whole $2 from FPMT to help support the translation of these types and production of these types of materials, but they gave us permission to give it to Venerable Ravina's students during this time period. So you can download it or get the copy tomorrow. Okay. Any questions? Okay, thanks. Venerable Ravina should be here any minute.
So here we are tonight to think about the meaning of attachment and distinguish it from love. Very depressing job. Be ready for it. It won't be nice. It won't be comfortable. It'll be awful. But we be brave, and we do this so we can become a little bit less neurotic, a little bit less needy, a little bit more kind. Even this much, already fantastic. So we can be a benefit to others. Sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab suchi jagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drobha shok sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab suchi jagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drobha shok sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab suchi jagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drobha shok. It really is a difficult one because in our culture we don't really have an equivalent. We do talk about attachment. We use the word neediness. That's attachment, you know. But we treat it as good. We think it's good to have it. And even more fundamental, we assume it's normal. And normal means you'd be abnormal if you didn't have it. And that's the real key point, that when you listen to Buddhist psychological model, the way to say it, the Buddhist view of the mind, the words are all so familiar, love, compassion, yeah, we know all that. But he's got this very distinct, very specific, unique way of describing states of mind, and his way of dividing the states of mind that's unique to the Buddha. So to hear the words we all know, but described very differently, and this is where we want to understand Buddhism, we have to understand how he talks about these states of mind, you know. So Buddha's simple point, as we all know, Buddha's simple point is that what he would call the negative, deluded, neurotic states of mind, well, neurotic, he would have liked that word. You know, they didn't use it back then, but he would have liked that, I'm sure. States of mind, which we think are completely part of a normal person. In other words, we, you know,
Buddha would say they're fundamentally different in their character, in their style, in how they make us feel, and in what they cause. Fundamentally different from what he would call the virtuous or the good ones, you know. So the negative ones he would call attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, depression, despair, panic. These ones, you know, we all know them oh so well. We're their best friends with us, you know. And then we've got love, kindness, generosity. So we know all these. We don't need to have Buddha tell us the difference between this lot. We all ask for the neurotic, fearful ones. We'd all have the same. We'd all put them under the same headings. But it's the way of understanding them. And the crucial point is, in the long term, what we can do with these states of mind. This is where Buddha's quite his own man, you know, quite unique. And it's really important to hear it if we're interested in using Buddha's approach. So Buddha's deal is, all the neurotic ones, he says, we don't need them. And the job of being a Buddhist, one way simply of talking about the Buddhist path, the Buddhist job is getting rid of them. The job is to get rid of them. The job is to completely rid your mind of them. The job is to completely rid your mind even to the subtlest atom of all this junk. Now, that's a very extreme view. That's a very extreme, radical statement. But that is exactly what Buddha means. And the word nirvana is the word you could use to refer to your mind when you've done that job. That's what he means. Not some nice, cute place called heaven, you know. Not like that. So that's an extreme statement. There's no model of the mind in our culture that would remotely indicate any possibility of doing this. You'd be considered insane if you thought you could completely get rid of ego, completely get rid of fear, completely get rid of attachment, anger, jealousy, low self-esteem, you'd be called psychotic. You know? No, definitely. But this is what Buddha's saying. Please hear it. It's so simple. It's insane. It's outrageous. So Buddha's either complete a wacko guy who's made up some ridiculous idea and is insane, or there's some validity in it. And it's up to us to find out. Buddha's not trying to push. He presents it. He's been going the same, saying the same thing for 2,500 years, as Americans would call it. Not 2,500, 2,500 years. He's been saying the same thing. Either he's stubborn or it works. You understand? So this is for us to look at. So interesting. So, there's this hierarchy in Buddhist psychology of the neurotic ones. And it's not complicated. So the root one, the mother of them all, the one that's underneath all the others, and we were talking about this one last night, and the simplest way to talk about that is this neurotic, a neurotic sense of a self, a neurotic sense of I. And we won't, you know, we'll see if we go into that. Not necessarily. But the main voice of that sense of an I is attachment to get what that I wants. And this is what drives every sentient being. Every dog, every human, every ant. And it goes to the subtlest, most primordial levels of our being. It's like at the level of just energy. It's beyond thought, at the subtlest level. It's what this energy of attachment, using the words loosely, is what drives us from moment to moment. I'll go this, do that, go here, have this, go there, want this, now that, now move my body, now go to sleep, now eat, now do this, go there, get a job, this boyfriend, that boyfriend, and then death. It's the motor that runs us. You know. It propels us. You know. So at a gross, it's got a multitude of facets to it. It's got many, many functions. And this is under the heading, speaking simple terms, Buddha's got these three headings of the categories of our mental consciousness, our thoughts and feelings and emotions. Negative, positive and neutral. There's no fourth category. Forget the neutral, okay? Don't worry about them. Negative and positive. These are the ones, when you're trying to work with Buddhism in your daily life, these are the ones that are our concern. So in simple terms, the negative ones, Buddha says, we don't need them. And his whole point of all his stuff, all his methods is to get rid of them. And why would you want to get rid of them? Because they cause you suffering, baby. And they cause you to harm others. Real simple. The good ones, the virtuous ones, He says they are at the core of our being. They are who we really are. They are who we really are. This is a big surprise to us because we think we're really the angry, we're really depressed, we're really the jealous. They're the ones we identify with. But no, Buddha says they don't belong. We can get rid of them. They've been there since the beginning of this time, but we don't need them. And this is a really tough job. And the good ones, as we get in the first stages of practice, you're focusing on getting rid of the junk. So the natural consequence of this is less junk, more goodness. You know, so and then you keep progressing, developing the goodness part of you, because this stuff is at the core of our being, is indestructible, Buddha says. It's almost like it's the very nature of your mind. And the good stuff, love, kindness, compassion, generosity, patience, you name them, they're the cause of your happiness and the cause of how come you make others happy. So it's not complicated. These concepts are not complicated. But the doing of this job is the most, is the toughest job we'll ever do, because we are addicted to the way we think about it now, which is that we're all born this way, I didn't ask to get born, it's not my fault, it's all completely natural, they're normal, you'd be weird if you didn't have anger, if you didn't have jealousy, if you didn't have depression, if you didn't have ego, you'd be weird. So we sustain these things and we uphold them and our whole world upholds them. Okay, when they get extreme, then we think that's not cool. So we feel you try to be a nice, balanced person. A little bit of anger, a little bit of love, a little bit of jealousy, a little bit of depression, and try to have a balance. That's about the best we can think. Buddha's way more radical than that. So, if this neurotic sense of a self is the main problem, and its main voice is this simple one called attachment, and its main job is to get what this self wants every microsecond. Every microsecond. And the, you know, the next one is coming from this, the millisecond it doesn't get what it wants. That's called anger. We've got polite words for anger. We only usually think of anger when a person shouts and yells, oh God, look, she's angry. No, quiet people are angry too. It's in the mind, the thoughts. Depression is internalized build-up of aversion. Aversion is the bare-bone state of mind beneath anger. And it's depression, guilt, frustration, annoyance, irritation, three very polite words for small anger, you know. And we go between this attachment and aversion like a million times a day. And they're utterly related to each other. And they're so quick that we don't notice them until they're very strong. And it's then it's, by then it's too late. Vesuvius has just exploded. It's too late then. So this is why, talking about being a Buddhist, you've got to be your own therapist to start go deep inside. So, in a daily life, the main problem, effectively the main cause of suffering, effectively, even though the root delusion is the cause of all suffering, but this attachment, the main voice of this ego, ego grasping, they call this main one, attachment, this simple word, is the main cause of our suffering. This energy that drives us desperately. Its energy is dissatisfaction. It then wants, yearns, needy, neurotically needy for something, the grossest level through the objects of the senses, and then at subtler level, the ones that are much more primordial attachment, attachment to what other people think of us, attachment to nice sounds, attachment to you know, comfort. These are much more subtle. Much harder to see. So one of our biggest problems in identifying these states of mind. It's like, you know, if you've got a garden out there, completely overgrown, weeds, herbs, flowers, vegetables, all entangled. If you're not a botanist, you can't tell one green thing from another, can you? I can't. I can identify, you know, a gum tree, as we call it in Australia, a eucalyptus tree. I can see a rose or a daffodil. That's about the best of it. When it gets all these herbs and weeds, forget it. I couldn't tell one bit from another, for sure. Well, our mind's like that. We can't tell one bit from another because there's you know, there's a million voices all at once, all shouting and yelling. And it's only when they're very strong, we'll go, oh, wow, I must be angry, because it's the loudest voice of all, you know. But they're usually just chatting away underneath there. 1,000 seconds a moment, you know, 1,000 voices a moment. It's really hard to hear the individual thoughts that are all in there that inform our emotions. They're so instinctive. Buddha says we come fully programmed with this stuff from the past. So, our biggest problem, like in the overgrown green stuff out there, if you don't know botany, you can't tell one bit from another. So how can you possibly be a decent gardener? Because you've got to start pulling out all the herbs instead of the weeds. You better learn some botany so you can identify one bit from another. Well, the same here. We've got to learn, the Buddhist view, learn Buddha's botany. You've got to know exactly what he means by a negative state of mind. What is attachment? What are its characteristics? And how does it differ from the herbs, from love, for example? So love and attachment for us go together like water and milk mixed together. We cannot tell the difference. We just can't. We don't even, when we have a relationship of loving somebody, we include in loving somebody being attached to somebody in the way we use the word in our culture. You love a child, you love your best friend, you love your husband, you love your new girlfriend. We use that to encompass a whole bunch of states of mind under the word love. But let's use Buddha's psychology to identify the different bits. And it will be just the same, in your relationship with a piece of chocolate cake. You've got two main states of mind there. There's millions, but the two ones we get confused between are attachment to chocolate cake and liking chocolate cake. So it's just like attachment to a person and loving a person. Actually, they're completely different, distinct states of mind. We can't tell them from each other. We wouldn't have a clue. We don't have a way of doing it. Because we're not that precise in the way we identify these different states of mind, So no wonder we're confused. No wonder we suffer. Because we can't tell the difference. And this is a tragedy. And this is a gross level of knowing your mind, I tell you. So attachment, like all the other neuroses, using Buddhist model of the mind, they have two main characteristics. They're very disturbing. And that should be a really good indicator. If you're trying to watch for what arises in your mind for something that is a negative state, then it will be disturbing. But the trouble is this disturbingness goes quite subtle. And we only notice it when it's very heavy disturbingness, That's our problem. But one of the characteristics of all these neuroses, and this is very distinct, like I'm saying in Buddhist psychology, they make you feel disturbed. Disturbing emotion is one of the terms for them. Now, when it's like full-on anger, you can tell a person is disturbed. They're basically having a mental breakdown. Look at them, They're having a mental breakdown. That's disturbed. Jealous. That's disturbing. Depressed. That's disturbing. Quiet disturbing, but disturbing. In other words, it's disturbing meaning not pleasant, not peaceful. So one of the characteristics of all these neuroses, and because we're so familiar with them, and it's so pervading our normal day, you can almost say we don't have a moment when we're not, to some extent, disturbed. And that's what Buddha's saying, basically. We're living in suffering all the time. It sounds very kind of heavy to think that. So this is where we're talking about subtler level of suffering. Buddha talks about levels of suffering. So we know that, when the bad things happen, you're homeless, you're chucked into prison, your hubby leaves you for the younger version, you get cancer, somebody punches you. That's what we would normally call suffering. So this subtler level of suffering, we tend not even to think of it as suffering. We just think it's normal until it gets to the gross level. So normal anger, we wouldn't think that's suffering. We just go, oh, that's just normal. Normal depression, normal jealousy, normal anxiety. We're so used to it, we don't even call it suffering. But the Buddha would say this is, I always quote this one from when all the friends, my friends in prison, when one of them wrote to Lama Zopa for the first time, and he wrote back, and Lama Zopa, and this guy's in his cell 23 hours a day with only the inside, the inside of a pen, in his top security prison in California, the inside of a pen because he could use the outside to stab his cellmate, no hardback because you can whack your cellmate with a hardback. He said to me in one letter, he's a Mexican, he said, "Is broccoli yellow, Rabina? Their food is so disgusting, you can't believe." So we'd call that gross suffering. And Lama Zopa said to him, he's in 23 hours a day in his cell, in his orange jumpsuit, 10 books, that's it. 1 hour up and down another cell with his shackles on, No air, hasn't seen the air for 20 years. And Lama Zopa said to him, your prison's nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. And this is what we're talking about here, which is a shock to us because we don't think we're in a prison. We don't think we're suffering until it's extreme. In other words, ordinary daily life of ordinary anger, ordinary attachment, ordinary depression, we'd be embarrassed to say we're suffering. We'd feel ashamed. Like, who am I to complain, you know? But this is the Buddha's point. When we start to look into our mind, we're going to see this. And what it should bring is not guilt, but is some kind of self-respect and some kind of, oh my God, I'm sick of this. Let me see what I can do about it. So there's ordinary disturbingness, you know? And then the good qualities, so we find it virtually impossible. So forget the person. We'll go to love and attachment in a minute. But let's just look at liking and attachment. No, we'll go to love and attachment. It's the best one. So so here we are, these social creatures, and we're social beings, aren't we? And I mean, it's the most normal thing in the whole world. We think it's just the way the universe is. Dogs do it, monkeys do it. You find a partner. Or more, depending. If you're born like some monkeys, they jump on their mummy the moment they come out the womb. They're jumping on mummy, grandpa, daddy, sister, brother, auntie. They don't want a partner. They just jump on everybody. That's a polite word, jump on. Okay? So we all assume we need to find a partner. This is fairly common, you know. And it's the way our cultures are. For centuries, all cultures do this. And of course, this is the hothouse of love and attachment. So if this is the way the world is, the vast majority of people go find a partner, and if you want to, always bring up these depressing numbers, and if you don't want to be among the 40% of all women murdered on this earth, by whom do you think? The other person in that hothouse with you, called your partner. That figure blows my mind. 40% of all women on earth who are murdered by their partner. So this says everything about attachment, okay? But we would go, oh, that's just what happens when you love somebody. You know? You fight all these things. But it's what happens when you have attachment. And that's where it's surprising. Because we know about anger. We know about rage and fear and jealousy. But with our ordinary worldly way of using these words, we would never link it to what we call attachment. So this is why it's so important, because Buddha uses this word a lot, to get what he means by it, you know. Therefore, to be able to distinguish, first, even theoretically, between attachment and love. So attachment's under the heading called negative. One of the neuroses. I know that we use the word differently, so we're not discussing what you're calling attachment. We're all allowed to have different definitions, aren't we? It's okay. You know, like if you learn geometry, you learn about a flat table. But if you live in England, you would live in a flat. And if you play music, you play B flat. So there's the same word, three definitions. You better get your definitions clear. So everyone in this room would have their own definition of attachment. That you're allowed to have that. I'm talking Buddhas here. So if you're going to communicate with me, you better have Buddhas for the sake of this discussion. The attachment he is talking about, the word, what he is referring to when he uses that word, is this bottomless pit, like I'm saying, of neediness, this dissatisfaction that already feels like I'm not even a whole person, that I'm a half a person, if not a tenth of a person, if not a no person at all. Dissatisfied, therefore absolutely default craving for something to fill me up, and the obvious level first is the objects of the senses, and then, of course, the major one, like I'm saying, is a person, a partner, friends, you know, all that, but the partner's the one, which seems to be where the strongest one is. You know, all our societies are based around the development of a partner and a family. Things are changing now, whatever, but that's pretty powerful for us, isn't it? So this attachment, feeling, causing me to feel I'm not whole, I'm not complete, I'm dissatisfied with who I am, with what I get, and therefore whatever I do get, it's never enough. As my mother would say, so powerful, so we know all these wonderful phrases, the more you get, the more you want. This is a function of attachment. It's a bottomless pit. But we don't realize that. We really believe when we get the cake, we'll get happy. We really believe when I get Fred, now I've found happiness. That's how attachment, you know, Buddhist one, the other characteristic of these disturbing emotions, there are two main characteristics. The other one, and this is the interesting point, is that they're liars. They're liars. They're delusions. They're misconceptions. They're not accurate assessments of things. So the simplest way to say that is that when I'm, quotes, in love with Fred, meaning massively attached to Fred, one of the functions of attachment is to make Fred look far more divine than he really is, which is very convenient. You look at him, you go, what are you seeing there, Ravina? We all know that one. So then what this brings, as we all know, when something looks extremely delicious, it gets the mind all excited. So there's an excitement. Even if it's just a chocolate cake, there's this excitement. And you can't wait to get it, isn't it? You can't wait to have contact with it. With the cake, it goes into this one, you know? Isn't it? You understand my point? So this is the energy of attachment. This is the bottomless pit of neediness, dissatisfaction. I must get something. Oh, there's a cake. Oh, that'll do it. And the more you have this neediness, the more divine the cake looks, the more dazzling it looks, dazzles at you, and it's begging you to eat it. The more you, it's all part of attachment, the more you anticipate the meeting of that cake and the experience of pleasure. Isn't it? And so it's irresistible. Irresistible. So then Fred, multiply that about 50 times, 1,000 times. In other words, the same dissatisfaction, the same yearning for something out there to make me happy, the same finding Fred looks divine, can't believe, finally I found happiness, the whole world is just like blissful, everything's dazzling and gorgeous because it's a divine person. And I mean, you understand what I'm saying? I'm not being cynical, we're discussing technically how attachment works. In Buddhist psychology, in the more advanced techniques especially, they describe this in quite subtle detail, the workings of this particular state of mind and how it causes this energy in the body, because this is the other tragedy of attachment, is that it triggers really nice feelings. And this is where we're completely imprisoned because of it, because we're all desperate for good feelings. So strictly speaking, attachment, which is a state of mind that over-exaggerates the deliciousness of Fred, is under the heading called negative. Then there's another characteristic called pleasure or happy feelings. It's perfectly valid to have happy feelings. That's called happiness. Completely reasonable. There's nothing negative about that. It's just a natural thing. The trouble is, this polluted, deluded, neurotic, exaggerating, distorted, needy, bottomless pit of craving that exaggerates the deliciousness triggers a happy feeling, so we assume they go together. And this is the problem. So, there's Fred, looking divine. And already, after the first week or day or month, depending how strongly you've been thinking in the past about partners and babies and houses, you're all planned out, you know. I'm not being rude. Then by now you've written your total novel for the rest of your life. It's all clear, crystal clear. You've got it all mapped out. We all do this. This is another function of attachment. It's very overexcited. And it's thinking, all the mind, it's the fantasy part of us that writes exactly all the story of what's going to happen. We have it all mapped out. And then because we've thought of it, we make the mistake of believing it will happen because we've thought of it. And that's why we're devastated when Fred doesn't turn up tomorrow and the whole dream collapses in a heap of nightmare. Because you've built up this story, anticipation. It triggers good feelings, overexcited, all the expectations. And then seeing it as absolute truth. I always quote poor old Nicole Kidman. I'm sorry, I like Nicole Kidman, but I read an article, an interview with her when she was still with Tom Cruise. And she said at the end of the article, I always quote this, "We will be together until we're 80. This is how attachment talks. In other words, because it's delicious now, we assume it'll be delicious forever. And we anticipate it and absolutely believe it'll be that because it's unbearable for us not to. But all this is part of what attachment does. It writes these elaborate stories and fantasies and then projects it into the future as an absolute truth. We can't distinguish facts from fiction when attachment's running the show, you know. And this attachment is working, like I said, all the time on everything. But this is an extreme example. So here we come, there's Fred. So then we say we're in love with Fred, which means mostly that the in love feeling is the function of attachment which triggers the very nice feelings in the body. And this is why it's nothing to do with guilt or anything. It's just talking technically, you know. So good feelings, we are desperate for good feelings. We want good feelings, and that's called happiness. But the tragedy is, we don't know how to trigger good feelings in us, which the Buddha would say are the natural state of our own mind. We don't know how else to trigger them except by getting a sense object. So, there's Fred. Because he's a human being, you just get to know him, and you listen to him, and he listens to you, and he looks at you with loving eyes, and he makes you feel blissful, and you make him feel blissful, and you're completely in love, and you see you only see his good qualities, and you completely think he's perfect, completely exaggerating him. His ex-wife does not see the same. But of course, you think she's stupid, you know. He must have given up for a good reason. Because now he loves me. I mean, you know what I'm saying. So love. Okay, now what's love now? The word love. If using it in Buddhist terms, not the terms we use. It's under the heading positive. And it's an altruistic state of mind. All the virtuous or good or positive states of mind. Love, compassion, generosity, kindness. We all know them. They are, like I said, not disturbing. The mind is peaceful and open when they're prevalent. When the delusions are prevalent, the mind is unpeaceful and closed and tight and separate and distressed. When the virtues are there, the mind is open and spacious. But see, our trouble is we have that sometimes, but they're always mixed together. We never have a moment of pure love, pure compassion. Just like we never have a moment of total, you know, total only attachment. Fortunately, as humans, we have enough love in this room, let's say some of us, have enough love and compassion that temper the attachment, that stop us from being total terrorists, you know. Because the person who's run by mostly their attachment, who then has rage when it doesn't get what it wants, and then will harm the others because of this, that's what, look at the world. Look at the world, you know. So love is a virtuous or altruistic state of mind. And how you would define that is very simple. It comes down to being a thought, which we can grow into a huge feelings when it's developed. But the bare bones of it is a thought. When you see someone happy, you're happy for them. I'm happy for you. That's an expression of love. Of course, one grows it to huge degrees, and we have great, much love for some people, real affection, but it's a delight in their happiness. That's love. So one thing you can simply say, any of the negative ones, attachment and all of the others, they're necessarily, there's a sense of a separate self, you know, over here, me here, there's this delicious thing over there, I've got to get it in me, you know? A feeling of bereft and lonely. And then when there's anger there, you want to push that thing away violently. There's always, with the ego ones, there's a sense of sort of separateness, you know. With the virtuous ones, there's a sense of connectedness. Check it out. It's obvious. If you're feeling friendly one day, just having a chat with your neighbor, there's a feeling of well-being, isn't there? There's a lightness. You feel pleasant. She feels pleasant. You agree with each other. You listen to each other's problems about your knee aches and your constipation and your headache or whatever it is, and you're sympathizing with each other. Well, that you just expressed love and compassion. Love is, oh, she's a really nice person. Oh, I'm so happy for you. You just won the lottery. Oh, I'm so pleased for you. That's called love, you know. Compassion, when you hear about a headache, oh, I'm so sorry, how can I help? That's compassion. So if everything's going nice, even a little conversation, you just express love, compassion, bit of patience, bit of generosity. They are the virtuous states of mind. And they're the ones that are the source of your own happiness and that give you the ability to help others. So love is completely different from attachment. Attachment is like a poison. If you saw it in yourself in a raw form, it's the mind of a vampire. It's the mind of a junkie. It is a bottomless pit of frantic, desperate, fear-based craving. Why, you know, when attachment doesn't get what it wants, it turns into anger, despair, resentment, grief, fear, hysteria. Why do you think among relationships, 40% of people who get, you know, 40% of, that figure blows my mind. 40% of all women on earth, it's not being mean about men or anything, 40% of all people who die in part, you know, it's women in relationships, it's their partner. Why? Why? Because of attachment. Frantic. All the fantasy, all the drama, all the expectation. And then because you've got no uncontrolled, you know, very uncontrolled mind, live in the fantasy, have no idea you've got a thing called attachment. And the irony of attachment is the more you've got it, the more miserable you are, the more small you feel, the more hopeless you are, the less self-confidence, the less contentment, the less sense of a self in a valid way. That's the tragedy of attachment. So get two people like that together, you have a recipe for disaster. It's sort of like a joke to think. You know, I remember reading in Vanity Fair one time, they do these funny surveys where people are most afraid. And the biggest percentage was in a bad neighborhood. And I thought, these people don't know what they're talking about. The bad neighborhood's the home. I mean, I'm not trying to be mean here because all you people got partners. But try to get across the point about attachment, how it is a source. If you have any suffering at all in your life, if you get angry, distressed, anxious, panic attacks, jealous, resentful, low self-esteem, arrogant, it's because you've got attachment. So that's why we all recognize it, you know. If you have fights with people, it's because you've got attachment. If you leave somebody for someone else, because you've got attachment. If you think you're a creep, it's because you've got attachment. If you're never satisfied, it's because you've got attachment. So for the Buddha, it's this massive, it plays a massive role in our lives. And why it's surprising to us, because we just think, we kind of dismiss it in our culture and just think, oh, it's normal. That being suffering is normal, you know. Buddha says we should be crying in tears of compassion for ourselves. Not guilt, compassion for ourselves. So, okay, to distinguish between love and this attachment, when you're all, everything's perfect and divine and Fred is divine, everything's going beautifully, it is virtually impossible, literally impossible, literally impossible. Because it all feels, because attachment triggers very pleasant feelings. And we're desperate for good feelings, which is called happiness, which is fine. And this is whole Buddha's point long term. He says, all he's saying is we all have the wish to be happy. Every being has the right to be happy. And all he is talking about is his methods of how to get it. Which is, and that's the irony. For us, happiness is what we get when attachment gets what it wants. For the Buddha, happiness is what you get when you give up attachment. So we better, if we want to check out his stuff, we better try and recognize it, you know. But I mean, don't hold your breath, okay? Way to go. So meanwhile, we've got to learn to identify it and then learn to live with it. So when is the best time to distinguish between love and attachment? Well, I'll tell you the best time is when attachment doesn't get what it wants. That's the second you start practicing. Because before then, you can't tell it's there. You know, my simple example, I go, you know, have a piece of chocolate, we go to the cafe, you know, Who are you? Scott. Scott and I, we like chocolate cake, okay? Remember, like is perfectly cool. Tibetans like their yak cheese. Australians like their Vegemite. So liking something is just a preference due to culture, you know? And of course we have attachment on top of that. But liking is just a perfectly fine state of mind. So, okay, Scott and I like chocolate cake. Oh, let's go get some chocolate cake. And you go, oh, that's really, isn't that nice? They just like chocolate cake. So we go order our chocolate cake. The same example I use every time. Now look what happens when carrot cake comes. And this is the point. This is the second you start to know, I will then discover I've got attachment because Scott will go, oh, that's cool. I can handle carrot cake with me. And he proceeds to enjoy it. I will go, excuse me, I order chocolate cake and get upset. And don't want to eat it, don't pay the bill, get all disturbed. But his response proves he, if he did have attachment, he was able to turn on a dime and change his mind and decided, it's cool, I can accept this. My response proves I had attachment and I didn't know how to change it. And that's why you go kill each other. Because we can't see it when it comes, and when the anger comes, we get completely caught up in that story, offended, hurt, insulted, upset, how dare I order, blah, blah, blah. That's attachment talking. We all recognize this one, and we just think it's normal. And it's so hard to get past this. Don't think it's easy. It's a phenomenally hard practice. But we've got to first acknowledge it as something to do, and begin to identify it, and then slowly, slowly work on our minds. Because the fact is, you know, when our attachment doesn't get what it wants, which will be 1,000 times a day, it's just the way the world is. Then we have to practice to be equipped to handle that moment when aversion will start. It's called annoyance, irritation. You know, some people might never get to a really strong one. They'll just get annoyed easily, get frustrated. You know, we call those polite words. They're the second attachment, didn't get what they want, but in a mild way, you know. It's like if your husband leaves you for younger version, the anger and the grief all come together with the jealousy, the whole works come, and it's overwhelming pain. But it's still because of attachment. This is the part that's so interesting. And this feels so cruel because we think it's normal. And Buddha says it is normal. But he's being more radical and says it's normal, people, but you can go beyond it. His methods are to help us go beyond it. That's all. He's been quite radical in saying it is possible to stop the suffering of it. So in other words, how would you be if you didn't have attachment? Because we can't even conceive of it. You just think you'd be this kind of nobody if you had no attachment. No. How you'd be, you'd be extremely content, quite joyful. You'd be confident. You'd be in charge of your life. You'd know yourself deeply. You'd have genuine love for others, genuine compassion, genuine kindness, genuine patience. You'd really have the best chocolate cake and the best sex in the universe. And I'm not trying to be stupid here. I really mean that sincerely. Because you're not grasping like a vampire and then getting distressed and despairing when you don't get what attachment wants. You'd be naturally joyful person. Buddha says, you look into the more deep, in the teachings in Buddhist psychology and all the literature, the Buddha talks about consciousness or mind as being pure in its nature. Our minds are fundamentally clear and pure. And what he means is that's our potential. And that's what you're like when you've removed the junk from your mind. Because once you've removed attachment, you wouldn't have anger. There's no way. You couldn't have jealousy. You couldn't have pride and all the others once attachment's gone. You practically realize emptiness and achieve nirvana already. You'd be this blissfully kind, loving, wise, fully content, joyful, wonderful person. You'd still fall in love because you've got certain history with certain people. You get enormous pleasure, enormous joy, but your mind won't go berserk. We can't conceive of being this way. You'd be the person you want to be. This is how Buddhism would talk, you know. So love and attachment are practically impossible to see when they're in the full, like even just chocolate cake. Liking and attached are virtually impossible until attachment doesn't get what it wants. So when you're feeling blissful about Fred, but slowly, slowly, we know the energy will calm down, you start living together, and then he starts to do things that annoy you. That's called attachment not getting what it wants. Right there. Then you forgive him in the beginning because it's only small. And then we all know it gradually grows. We know that. That's why then the torture, the nightmares, the dramas, the suffering, the divorces, the murders, the pain, the grief of relationships lost, you know. Heartbreaking. Unbearable. But if we don't see it coming from... In other words, when you see a person looking divine in love and blissful on the wedding day, it seems cruel, doesn't it, to try and anticipate the suffering that could come in the future. It seems unfair and cruel. And when you're in the midst of that bliss, it's inconceivable that you'll, you know, hate this person one day. And it's not that you should think you would. But we can't even see it because we're so blissed out in the throes of the attachment, the bubble, you know. So one of the things the Buddha says about all these neuroses is that they're blind. We can't see reality. We all know that. When you really hate Fred now, since he's given you up for a younger version, you don't remember any of the good things. You don't remember any of the good feelings. You only see the bad. You hate every fiber of his being now. So just like when you're in love with him, you can't imagine all the bad things. So when you hate him, you can't remember the good. They're so extreme, you know. This is how we are, you know. So we know this. This is expressing what we all know already. But this is the Buddhist explanation of why and what to do with this and how to slowly change this internal process. But we're talking heavy-duty stuff here, you know. Sounds kind of funny. Well, maybe not funny. Love and attachment. Oh, my God, you know. So, you know, the best scenario for the Buddhists, the best scenario, the best way to give up attachment and these delusions and get ahead of the game is give up sex, drugs and rock and roll, go become a monk or nun and go to the mountains. It's the most direct way to do it, you know. Quickest. Simple. No problem. But 99% of us won't do that. So it's sort of like 99% of us won't give up alcohol. So we have to work on giving up attachment to alcohol while continuing to drink it. That's how hard the job is. Do our best. And be humble and patient. Rejoice in your progress one step at a time. But the key is to begin to distinguish between these states of mind, which for us are this big soup of emotion right now. Can't tell one bit, like a big soup. You can't tell one, a pea from a carrot from the bit in the middle. And not only that, it's a pureed soup. It's virtually impossible to see one bit from another, you know, because it's this big kind of soup of emotion of me, you know. The whole point, again, is this business of being our own therapist, learning to develop this sense of respect for ourselves, a sense of who we are, a sense of being myself and looking at what I think and feel and who I am and what is valid and what is not valid. It's a huge job, this introspective job of becoming my own person, you know. So, of course, most of us will be doing it in relationship to others, but within that, we need to find some space. This is why, too, to me, the heartbreak of relationships, because we're mostly not rich. I mean, all the French and English aristocrats would have separate bedrooms. Very civilized, I tell you. I bet they don't kill each other. Because you get some space, you know. Even children. I mean, I think in our relationships, this is something we really, really lack, actually. I mean, in my family, mummy and daddy, you know, mummy and daddy, and then seven children. And we were, you know, my mother had babies quicker than they could make the money. So, you know, I always struggled. My father would go and spend it playing snooker and drinking alcohol and everything. He was a darling father, but he wasn't very responsible. And my mother then ran the family business, the printing business, and taught music because she was a musician, and then sent us to all the fanciest Catholic convents. I think she still owes the bills, you know, the most expensive ones. So always money was a struggle. So we had a house with, you know, three bedrooms for nine people. One for mum and dad, and then the other seven of us, we shared two bedrooms. It was just the way it was. You didn't complain. I'm not complaining. But what I'm getting at here is this. When we're all ordinary people with lots of attachment, and when you have close relationships, like in a family, you know, Buddha would talk, of course, about past karma and strong karmic history with each other. So you come running, seven of us all went running to the same womb, you know, pretty intense. Strong history with each other. You know what it's like in close relationships. So so from the time we're born, we're living in each other's faces, living with each other every day. So, of course, the intensity is so powerful, the closeness, but the intensity of the dramas that come along because of that closeness. So what I'm getting at is, you know, I'll never forget when I was 13, and first I was very holy. I was always naughty, but in my heart I was holy. I loved God and Our Lady and the saints. I go to Mass every day. And anyway, at the same time, I liked God. I also liked boys. I don't know how I put these two together, but I wanted to be a nun and I liked boys as well. I can't work it out, but never mind. Anyway, at some point, my mum freaked out. And I was about 13, I think, 14. And I was walking and I stole her high heels about the time of Elvis. And in Australia, we were called bodgies and widgies. I know in England, they call them the teddy boys. Remember the 50s? I don't know what you call them in America. What were you called then? In the time of Elvis. The teddy boys with their hair, you know, all slicked back with the, you know, like Elvis's hair. Well, in Australia, we were bodgies and widgies. The girls were the widgies and the boys were the bodgies. It was huge. And the girls, we had like little hearts around our neck with Elvis written on it and little studded belts and full skirts and high heels and pink lippies from Woolies, you know, and pink fluorescent earrings that I got from Woolies. Stole my mother's earrings. Stole my mother's high heels, and I was walking, you know, down the street, trying to seduce Tony Kinkota, who was 16, the greengrocer's son. Well, my mummy completely freaked out, so she sent me to boarding school. So what I'm getting at is this. I was then 13, 14. She sent me to boarding school. Well, it was, to me, this is my point I'm getting to, which is quite a big point for me in my mind, what I learned. It was an absolute miracle, because I had space for the first time in my life. So up until then, with the nine human beings intensely close together, therefore love and kindness, yeah, but you're in your face all the time. No wonder people kill each other in relationships. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic here. It is heartbreaking because we're ordinary human beings in your face. I mean, my friends in prison, in these cells where they're locked up 23 hours a day, two men to a cell. They kill each other regularly. Excuse me, think of your small bathroom, 8 foot by 10 foot, no windows, locked in there 23 hours a day with your best friend. You would kill each other. Think about it. I'm not kidding. Think about it. Well, that's how we live our lives, because we're poor. We don't have separate bedrooms. Forget about separate beds, some people. So you're in your face every day. And because we have no awareness of our minds, therefore we're only noticing the outside, because we have masses of attachment to get what I want, because everybody else out there is not doing what I want, so I'm going to get angry. I spent my life raging, feeling suffocated, you know. Two of my sisters got asthma. We joke now about how it suffocate them with a pillow, because I was nearly going crazy every night because I couldn't sleep. I mean, it sounds cruel, but when you're in together like this, it's too much for human minds. It's too much for ordinary human beings. And then when I went to boarding school, I had my own bed. I had discipline. I studied for the first time. I passed my exams for the first time. There was silence. I can't describe the pleasure, because, in other words, I began, because I had the external condition, I began to see myself for the first time. I began to taste my own potential for the first time. Are you seeing what I'm saying here? So it is too much to bear. It's too much to ask us ordinary humans who don't have any awareness to be around other ordinary humans who don't have any awareness all the time. It's just, we don't get this point. My mother was a really intelligent person. She never got this point. So there was these, and also we all tend to be this way with children. Oh, it's the kids, you know. They're all the same. Put the kids together. There are 7 different human beings there, each with their own needs, their own minds, their own personalities. But we don't pay attention. We don't go deeper than the surface, you know. This is, it's like so important. And if I can't, of course, if I can't see my own mind, how in the name of God can I see my children's, you know, and know what they need? I mean, it's the most intense job to be as a parent. We need to give time, individual space, time. And the point is here, I'm talking as adults, we need to take the time. We need to take some space. But because we're so attached to each other, we run to each other like a magnet, and then we invite the problems. And then when the problem comes, you can't wait to get back to the person again. We're just like joined at the hip, you know. We don't even know how to be on our own. We feel panic-stricken if we're on our own. We feel lonely on our own. What do you think loneliness is? You don't think you're worthwhile. So unless you speak to another person, you are nobody. That's what loneliness is. It's an appalling, depressing self-loathing. Because we're not used to looking inside, and because we never have an external condition that encourages us to look inside. I'm not trying to be holy about it. It's just common sense. No wonder we all have mental breakdowns. No wonder we all kill ourselves, each other and ourselves. No wonder we all need space, because we're so stressed, because we can't deal with our own mind. How hell am I supposed to deal with another person's crazy mind? So no wonder we harm each other, you know. It's just inevitable. This is all because of attachment. For Buddha, this is a subtle, subtle, subtle state of mind that is so pervasive, that is the source of so much pain, which gives rise to anger, jealousy, and all the others, you know. So we might not go to the mountains and give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which is the best way to go inside, do the job real quick. We mightn't, you know, we're mostly going to have whatever, people. But we need to be civilized about it for our own sake. Which means to want to have some time on my own. Not out of a, because you hate everybody. No, usually we either have people who are complete people, and who need to be around people all the time, or people who are depressed and hate people. That's not what we're discussing. We need to learn. I mean, I sound so corny, to be our own best friend, you know. Because how can I begin to listen to my mind if I can't be on my own? It's impossible. Utterly impossible. So we need to take some space. Take some time. And don't wait till you have a mental breakdown. That's too late. And begin to see my own mind. And then I can be cautious in relation to others and not fall into the trap of the anger and the hurt and the pain and the jealousy when the attachment doesn't get what it wants. You know? What do you think? Any questions about all that? Can you tell that? I mean, anyway, any questions? No? Can you tell the difference between love and attachment? You kind of got the idea? A little bit? Okay. Nobody?
Oh,
Okay. Go.
Why is it if attachment is such a problematic state that it triggers pleasure in us?
I know, it's kind of, this is the tragedy of it. Okay, how to talk about that one? It's kind of interesting. Because this, you see, in order to understand this, we've got to get a bit of a bigger picture in Buddhist perspective of what a human being is and how we became a human being. So Buddha would say, remember, we're not created by a creator. We're not just made by mummy and daddy. We're given a body by our mummy and daddy. But if we look at the evolution of mind, and Buddha's view is much broader and even beyond this planet, I mean, in terms of time, that attachment is the energy over a long time that actually caused us, it's sort of like personal evolution, caused us to end up having a body that is a body of the five senses. This body is necessarily of the five senses, isn't it? Our mind is connected to this body. And the energy of attachment is what has caused us to have five senses, which in their nature need to be fed. Isn't this true? The five senses need feeding, don't they? Wouldn't you agree? So that's a product of attachment. So we're like locked into this attachment. So the point is, our mind, Buddha says, which is not the body, when we really developed our mind using Buddhist understanding of what we do, using these meditation techniques, where we necessarily go beyond the body, which doesn't exist in our culture, of course. So when you learn these meditation techniques, which come from the Hindus, and then Buddha took these meditation techniques, they call them concentration meditation. Or mindfulness, more common known now. So when you really develop that to the full extent, and you were to see a person who'd gone to these subtler levels of their own mind, beyond the gross level, beyond the level of physicality, beyond the brain, which we don't even think exists, then at that level of mind, if you saw a person at that in that state, and this is a very common one, this is now for thousands of years people have been doing this, they would look like they were dead. Because they've literally ceased the gross level of physicality, ceased the brain, ceased the physical, ceased the senses, and they've gone to this subtler, more refined level of their own consciousness. Do you understand? Just technically. So that level of mind where even temporarily you've ceased the gross level, you've also ceased attachment and all the neuroses. So just naturally at that level, in other words, a mind, the consciousness, when it's unencumbered by the gross attachment and gross concepts and gross anger and gross junky stuff, which is related to this body, is naturally blissful. It is naturally, in its state, naturally happy. So the mind now, caught up with this gross body, caught up in attachment and anger and fears and neuroses, is naturally very disturbed. And we don't know how to access our own capacity for joy or pleasure, which is a technical point. So the only way we know how to trigger a pleasant feeling in our own mind is by sticking one of the objects in one of the five senses, basically. Do you see what I'm saying? A little bit? Does that make sense? So the long-term goal, Buddha says, which sounds so holy and abstract, he talks about that every person, every being, every mind possessor, the term in Tibetan for a sentient being is a mind possessor, we all have naturally the potential to go beyond the neuroses and the delusion and to access our more subtle level and train our minds at that level to access joy and go beyond the delusions, and then out of compassion you'd be in your own body again, but you would not be caught up in the misery any longer. You would have trained yourself to be able to be joyful and blissful and loving and kind and wise and happy, because that they're our true state. But we're just covered by the pollution right now and addicted to the pollution, addicted to these methods of being sensory, like junkies basically.
It's rather perverse, though, isn't it?
It is perverse. It's tragic, in fact. It's like we're all junkies. And the only way we know how to have any good feeling is by having an injection of heroin, you know? And anybody looking on, whether it's an alcoholic or extreme attachment, we can see, you know, it is the downside of that. And so all Buddha's saying is, having any attachment at all, we're all junkies. It's just a question of degree. Do you see? Which sounds so depressing, I know, I understand. And perverse, indeed. Yeah, that's right. The gentleman behind you.
I'm just trying to clarify this one in my mind.
Yeah.
So, attachment, there are two types of attachment. One is primary and another is secondary.
What do you mean?
I'm explaining.
Okay, beg your pardon.
So, secondary one is, like, I like Lisa. That's the secondary one. But the primary attachment is my mind, that I I'm attached to myself. I think myself in such a way. So that's the root cause of attachment, to attach to myself. Am I correct interpretation? The two type of attachment. One is attachment to the outside, attachment to the
inside. Well, you could say it that way, but they're the same attachment. You see, attachment is a state of mind that over-exaggerates the deliciousness of something, the importance of something. So it's all a question of degree and of the object. Some people, it's food is the object of attachment. Some people, it's the way their body looks is the object of their attachment. Another person is attached to music. Another person is very attached to having other people like them. We've all got these in variations, but attachment is the same. It wouldn't divide it necessarily in that way. Of course, the deepest attachment is to our own sense of self and our own body, primordially deep, just clinging to them. Yeah, sure. So it's just a question of degree, really. Attachment is attachment is attachment. There's just a degree. Do you see what I'm saying? Yes.
Can you share with us some ideas of how to weaken the attachment?
Well, that's what this whole practice is all about. That's what any teachings you've ever heard are all the very methods that you and you know about them. You're already practicing them, aren't you?
I would like to hear them again from you, yes.
Well, the starting point, it's like the analogy, use the analogy of being an alcoholic, which is a gross example of a function of attachment. The craving for that thing when it's not there, the over-exaggeration of its power, you know, its ability to make you happy, and then the downside of it, because the more you get it, the more you want it. We get that, don't we? We understand that. So use that as our analogy for all attachments. Then obviously the first level of practice has to be to give up the object itself, to remove yourself from the object, or at the very minimum to control that the physical experience of the object. You see my point? That has to be the first one. So the very first level of practice in Buddhism, just like your grandma tells you, is behave nicely. So this is something that it doesn't seem very evident to us. If we look into our own mind and we realize we've got lots of attachment and neediness and then lots of anger and lots of jealousy and lots of fears and depression and anxiety and worries and jealousy, all the other drugs, you know, join the club. All our own story, all our own variations, all triggered by this constant sense of dissatisfaction. Okay, so knowing we're like that, then every time, we might not go around raping and killing too many people. I would suggest. Okay? Maybe we'll kill a few roaches and a few ants. We're not the multi-murderers and the terrorists of the world, maybe, in this room. I doubt. Unless we've just given it up, you know? Which well done. So you get my point. So if you look at most of us, especially humans, the harm we mostly do to each other, I would suggest, is with our speech. Would you agree with that? We shout at each other. We use harsh words. We criticize behind backs. This we absolutely love to do. We think it's a virtue, practically. We say things that aren't true. We just rabbit on blur about nothing, exhausting everybody. So we sound so minor and so kind of, it just seems like normal behavior. So now, if everything that we do with our body and do with our speech is linked to what's in our mind, which is hardly rocket science to think that, would you agree? Then obviously, if you say negative things and harsh things and critical things and not fair things, you're vomiting out your own misery and I'm so depressed and I'm hopeless, blah, 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 what do you think you're feeding? Your own internal misery. So if just for one day we decided I would never say a bad word about somebody, I would never just rabbit on about nothing. I will only say true words, and I won't speak harsh words. I mean, it sounds so miniature, but just that is miraculous. So who immediately, everybody else will get the benefit, but the real beneficiary will be me. And what will that mean? I will start to calm my mind down, because the vomiting words are like putting oil on the fire. So it's impossible to begin to even see our mind if my behavior is uncontrolled. Because behavior is what impacts upon others and what does harm to others, and therefore what harms me. So the first level of practice has to be, you know, control your body and speech. It sounds so boring, but it's quite profound in the meaning, you know. Already, when you harness your own physical energy, discipline, in other words, controlling your behavior, don't harm others, then already you're beginning to benefit yourself, because now you're calming down your own stuff. And this is the point for us now, our trouble in our culture. We either have the uncontrolled body and speech, but we also have people who don't have uncontrolled body and speech, who don't go harm others, but their minds are berserk and there's no awareness. So for both of us, there's no awareness of the mind. So at least, maybe you have to say for the person who's got good behavior, they've got to listen to their own mind. And the person who's got bad behavior has to calm it down, so then you can begin to pay attention to what the hell is going on in our own mind. Because then we can begin to start working on attachment itself. But it's virtually impossible until you know, and so for most of us, maybe the physical one will be stuffing in the food. Too much alcohol, jumping on anybody because, you're attached to sex. It's not being fundamentalist. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. But because we're uncontrolled and berserk and undisciplined, we harm ourselves and we harm others. So the very first level is, can you imagine if we had, even in our own family, between us, our friends, our work, we had disciplined behavior. It sounds so old-fashioned, it's like hilarious. Polite to each other, didn't harm each other. 90% of our problems would be gone. But of course you have to add to that the introspection of knowing the benefit to your own mind of doing that, not just doing it because you think you're a good girl, because people will like you, or because it's supposed to be done. No, it's the first step in beginning to unpack and know your own mind, so we can really start to get to the nitty-gritty of understanding these different thoughts, different feelings, different emotions, and distinguishing between one and the other, One step at a time. Of course, for a Buddhist, you have to begin with some, you do this as your first commitment, to try and control your body and speech, and then to have some kind of simple practice, morning and night, where you begin to train our mind into getting some focus. Because we might not, most of us in this life, get what they call single-pointed concentration, this super advanced level of incredibly refined, subtle mind. But we will, from the first moment of beginning to do 5 minutes even of just watching our boring old breath, just watching, disciplined, not getting caught up in all the thoughts, focusing the mind on something. From this, we will then learn to pay attention to what's happening in here, not just what's happening out there. And that's the job we have to learn, to begin to notice that what's going on in our mind is huge, So we have to start somewhere, slowly, 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 Someone else?
Good evening, and thank you for being here again.
Okay.
So I had another teacher who told me that the practice I should have is to be grateful for whatever I receive.
Grateful for what you receive.
Right. Whatever comes into my life. And so you talked about the two people, and the one person reacted poorly to getting carrot cake, and the other person was able to be happy with the carrot cake.
Yes.
And so this teacher said, whatever comes to you, accept that and be grateful for this.
We can see, it's perfect. We can see, can't we, there's lots of different approaches, aren't there? There are lots of different approaches, aren't there? That is definitely one approach. It's not the one I'm discussing here, because then I would have a debate with you and say, grateful to whom?
To myself.
But receive from whom?
That the universe has given it to me.
Okay, now we're getting to it. That's a whole different philosophical discussion, because I wouldn't talk that way in Buddhism. Buddha would say, you created it. I'm just now discussing this point, but I'm not criticizing this approach, but that's not the approach I'm taking here, because there's different approaches. Now, if a person in this room has a lot of devotion in Jesus Christ, their whole practice would be to refer back to God. That's totally perfect. You mentioned the universe. The Buddha would suggest the one of karma and your own past virtue and owning responsibility for the fact that you have anything at all. But that it's sort of like another take on it. This particular specific discussion here is to learn to identify this particular disease we have called attachment. But I don't disagree with your approach, but it's another technique. There's a million techniques, aren't there?
I would say
yes,
they probably
definitely
are.
Yes.
The other thing about this technique is that he says don't have desires, have preferences. So that by not having a strong desire, but having a preference, when it doesn't come in front of you, you don't react
good.
To
perfect.
It.
Perfect. Another great technique. There's hundreds.
Okay.
I agree with you. Totally.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Someone else. Behind you, sweetheart.
So, if I remember correctly, you mentioned that the Buddha said the primordial state of mind is of joy. Or
when the mind is all full, when you've done the job that he lays out of getting rid of the junk, that all that's left is joy and love and compassion and wisdom and kindness and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, all the good stuff, yeah.
So the implication wouldn't then be that, like, as an infant, that would be the state of your consciousness.
No, the Buddha would say, you know, Hitler didn't begin. We all come with our own junk and our goodness. We come fully programmed with bucket loads of history from the first second of conception. The Buddha's view would say that.
So my question really is, like, how do you raise a child in order to, like, from the very beginning, start to develop this non-attachment?
Well, the first step has to be you know how to do it.
Yeah.
And then you, with your wisdom, you'll see, when you know your mind, you have the wisdom to see their mind. So you will be able to recognize whether you've got a Hitler baby or a Mother Teresa baby. I'm not kidding here, but, you know, psychos have mummies. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Terrorists, and I'm not being mean here. We don't like to think that people begin being terrorists. But the Buddha would say, this is a view of karma, that we all, Buddha doesn't talk about the universe providing us, that's fine. Buddha doesn't talk about a creator or parents, but we come programmed with our own past tendencies. A whole bunch of them ripened a few weeks before conception, and then our mind comes into this life from the first second of conception, programmed with all our tendencies, our characteristics, the kind of people we're going to meet, the things that will happen to us, what we're like. So the more you know your mind, the more you can identify your child and know what their problems are, what their virtues, what their goodness, what their blah, and therefore you will know how to teach them, know how to. Without this, you can't possibly. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Someone else. Yeah. Wendy, talk to me, my dear.
A common problem. Someone you love very
much. A bit louder.
Someone you love very much. Is this working?
Yes, it is now.
Okay. Someone you love very much.
Yes.
Does not like you at all.
Oh, well, this is a very tragic one, isn't it? So painful, isn't it?
And has done many very
terrible
nasty,
yes.
sneaky things behind
yes.
your back
yes.
to slander you to other people.
Yes,
and
yes.
you find out a long time later and
uh-huh.
have no way to defend yourself.
Absolutely, yeah.
Try to keep on loving this person.
Okay, there's different.
Haven't seen them for many years.
I know.
See them again, and this huge, dark, heavy air of utter distrust and dislike arises in your heart in spite of your best intentions.
Of course it does, because we're
what
human.
What to do?
What to do is keep seeing that you've got a long way to go. And we keep practicing. It's like if you go, you're playing tennis with your best friend, you look pretty good, but if you play with Federer, you go, oh my God, thanks for showing me what I can't do. So this is the one, honey, this is it. We have to know what we've got to learn to do and never give up. Because this is a painful one, you know? This is a painful one. This is why, you know, I talk about how, just we talk about love and compassion and good heart. It sounds so kind of nice, but it's so difficult. It's like, you know, it's easy to be happy when you get the chocolate cake, but the simplest thing, when you expect the chocolate cake, the irritation, the stress. So forget about the person whom you've been kind to, who is a friend or your family or your ex-husband or your beloved or your sister or who knows, everybody in this room has got a person of some kind who's gone against us, who criticizes, who badmouths us behind backs, who believes we did things we didn't do. I mean, it's like a nightmare. And so it's the most intense practice to be able, and this is another discussion again now, this means that the practice here, I mean, there's so many approaches to this one, but one of the fundamental points, if we look at this particular attachment, way more subtle than attachment to objects of the senses, this is the deepest, most primordial attachment, which is the attachment to how we are seen by others. This is the one that's attacked here. Because, in other words, our very sense of self at the moment, the neurotic sense of self, as Buddha talks, is completely bound up in this deep assumption that other people need to see me as a good person. If we, when you're in a household of other people, you're always having a sense of what they're thinking of you, what, you know, whether they're noticing what you're doing or not noticing what you're doing. You're driving down the freeway. You're worried about all the other people, what they're thinking. You're in the restaurant. You're worried about what people are thinking about me. This is a we call it being self-conscious. This is they call it in Buddhism attachment to reputation. Means attachment to what other people think of us. So when we really have low self-esteem, which means a bucket load of dissatisfaction, we just actually think we're nobody. This is why we suffer so badly, because we are frantic to have other people approve of us. So when they don't approve of us, this is why people literally go mad. And this is the one that's attacked. This is the one that it points to. So in other words, again, we can't conceive of how you'd be if you didn't have this attachment to what other people think. How you'd be is completely, fully content in who you think you are yourself. Fully satisfied, highly developed, less attachment. You'd be less angry, less jealous. You'd be loving, you'd be forgiving, you'd be compassionate. And like our mothers would all say, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words can never hurt you. It sounds so cute, but it's a statement of a profoundly developed person when you can be like this. Or when you know that a person, in other words, what a person thinks of us actually has nothing to do with what we actually are. And this is sort of like mind-blowing to think this, because our own sense of self in the deluded sense is so bound up in what other people think of us. We literally can't tell the difference. And we are constantly craving for other people to like us, respect us, think we're good. And that's why we try to have our good things seen by others, and that's why we try to hide our bad parts. Because we're constantly craving this one. And I think more than sex in relationships, more than anything, this is the one that is the torture when that goes in a relationship. The pain of being given up by somebody. Are you seeing what I'm saying? This is so primordial inside us. And this is why we suffer. If we didn't have this, we all know it. It's easy to say it. But we've got to start somewhere. We've got to know where the goal is, you know. Way to go to get to this point. But here we're trying to identify certain diseases, if you like, you know. Which we all have completely. So we have to become it sounds so ironic. We've got to become our own person. Well, right now we're sort of like, yeah, we've got to become who we really are. And that's why we have to have, again, introspection, why we have to have space. Because the Buddha's view is, and I'm not saying Buddha owns these views. Lots of people think these things, but I'm just using Buddha's way of saying it here. That we have every single potential inside us right now. We have the potential for goodness and compassion and love and bliss and fulfillment and contentment and blah, blah, blah. You name the good ones, that's all there waiting to be grown. You know? And so, of course, just like getting the carrot cake, it's a great practice to simply buy into how dare you not give me what I want. That just perpetuates the suffering. So every time we don't get what we want, whether it's the carrot cake or whether it's a person who's beloved, whom we love, being mean to us, that's the moment of practice. That's the second that practice begins, and that's what's hard. That's what's painful. That's what's difficult. But this is when we're really beginning to grow ourselves, become our own person when the thing comes along, like, you know, and attacks that part of myself. Okay, more to learn. It's so hard. My goodness. So incredibly difficult. But this is the one. I'll never forget. This is a strange experience I had years and years and years ago. I remember I was telling this story in detail one time. I'll just tell it briefly here. But it was way years ago, before I became a Buddhist. And I was sort of an old hippie, sort of whatever I was. And somehow these people I was, you know, living with, this doesn't matter where it was or anything. Well, it was in this country years ago. And I have to tell the whole story, then it gets complicated. Doesn't matter. At some point, some people began to not trust me. And they became convinced that, like, I was really evil. They thought I worked for the CIA. It was like insane, you know, really demented. And in the end, I had to talk my way out of this demented experience. And in the end, the people said, you are either the nicest person we've ever known. You are either the nicest person we've ever known, which meant that whatever I appeared to be was simply straightforward, or you're the worst person, which meant everything I was showing was all a lie. And they just said, we can't decide. You are either the nicest person we've ever known or the worst. But we just can't decide. So they didn't know how to interpret the evidence, in other words. So what I realized even then, the beginning to realize, was what people think of you has got zero, please hear this word, this is an accurate statement, has got zero to do with what you actually are. But we don't even know what we actually are, and we define ourselves completely in terms of what other people think we are. That's why you want to kill yourself if people don't like you. And that's why you think you're divine when a person's in love with you. Do you see what I'm saying? When a person's in love with you and they're looking at you with loving eyes, you feel like you are a goddess incarnate. You feel completely blissful, don't you? Because a person is adoring you. This is a marvelous feeling to have someone love us. There's nothing wrong with love. But I'm looking at the depth of the neediness. Without that, we think we're nothing. We think we're nothing. That's what we mean by loneliness. You've got all your thoughts in your mind. Why do we need so desperately to have someone else know our thoughts? Why is it not enough that we can have our own thoughts and our own conversation with our own self about ourselves? But we truly think it's normal to be lonely and think there's no one to talk to. It's wonderful to have someone to talk to, but we have to look at why we crave to have someone to talk to us. That's attachment to what other people think. We just think it's normal behavior. We think it would be abnormal to be the other way. It doesn't mean you don't care what people think. It means you become your own person and you are content with who you are. And then you're such a great person to be around, you'll have so many friends you won't know what to do with them. But when you're needy for the friends and needy and then so injured by an insult, it's because we have no certainty, no confidence in who we are. This is how you bring up a child. By seeing their mind, by being wise, tough love if it's needed, love and kindness, feedback, listen to them, support them, praise them, be grateful, give them bucket loads of food, good verbal, mental food, but also strict and clear. But it was like, you know, with my mummy, who was so overwhelmed by her dramas with her own husband and dramas with raising money, you know, working until midnight every night. She loved her children, but she couldn't pay attention. She didn't have the mental energy and the time. So we're just these raging seven kids bringing ourselves up in a way, you know. My mother was a wonderful mother, but you understand what I'm saying, people. But if we have a bottomless pit of neediness for something, you're going to have 27 people tell you they love you every day, and you will not believe a single word they say, and that's the irony, when you have a neediness to be seen by others. And that's attachment. This is the worst attachment. This is why people literally go mad when they're insulted or offended or hurt or abused or accused. I always remember one example. I always quote this. Two different people in prison I knew about, heard about, I didn't know the people, I heard about at the same time, both on death row, both wrongly accused of murder. And one of them, this woman, I mentioned this story, she was on death row in Florida for 17 years, accused with her husband of murdering these police. They were hitching a ride, and the two drivers actually killed the police, and then they blamed the little hippie hitchhikers, you know? So these two hippie hitchhikers were sent to prison, the husband got executed, they were innocent. 17 years of hell. She lost her kids. Husband was executed. She finally was found to be innocent because the guys confessed. But she said, I could change nothing. But I knew they couldn't take my mind from me. So she did yoga. She practiced. And she came out of this experience like a nightmare, but a stronger, wiser, more fulfilled person. The other person I read about, who was also on death row, also innocent, literally went mad, screaming in agony every day, I did not rape and kill that woman, until he went completely out of his brain. So you could say, speaking simply, one had somehow could find within herself an ability to become her own person, to give up the attachment to reputation because she had none of it. Everybody from the police, the prosecutors, the jury, the judge, the warders, everybody. She was a policeman killer. But she kept her sanity and became her own person. So she became strong in the face of this level of criticism. The other guy completely went mad. And this is the depth of this attachment we have. That believes I'm nothing until I'm seen as good by others. It's a nightmare, you know, and it runs us every day. So to really begin to even know what we think ourselves and not be scared of what other people think. Or I should think this because they think. One example of this too I keep quoting. This woman, some Australian nurse in England, did, you know, interviewed dying people. And she wrote a book called The Five Greatest Regrets of the Dying. And the greatest regret was not following what I wanted to do myself, not following my own heart, but doing what I thought other people expected me to do. This is all connected to the same thing. We don't even know what we want to do. We're too scared to follow it because we're worried about what people think. We often say we won't do that because we don't want to upset people. We mostly don't want other people to not like us. This is the deepest attachment of all, the deepest, most primordial attachment, attachment to being seen as good by others. And it's so linked to our very neurotic sense of self, you know. So it needs enormous courage. This woman, can you imagine the courage she had to have for this? To come out of that not bitter, but to be more fulfilled in herself. A sadness you couldn't take away. But she didn't go mad. She found herself, in other words. And she had enough confidence in herself because she was getting no good feedback. From the top to the bottom, she was evil. She saw them. She was seen as evil, but she knew herself, and she didn't rely on being seen as good for her own sanity. This is the hugest one. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
This is attachment, quite subtle level. So, slowly, folks. And this is the point that I just find optimistic. I mean, you know, okay, I'm brought up a Catholic. I've been many other things at the moment. I'm using the Buddha's view. I'm not saying it's the only view. It's the one that works for my mind. What can I say? And so for me, that I find most encouraging is it's so important for me that I felt when I first became a Buddhist, caught up in my own dramas, all this stuff I'm talking about. I know it. I can talk about it because I recognize it. Okay? Join the club. So what I've learned, the thing that kept me going was to know that I had potential. It was up to me. I had potential. And it just takes time. It just takes time, you know. This is what I'm seeing. We've got to have a lot of courage, a lot of confidence, a lot of perseverance, and kind of use logic to argue with ego's misconceptions, you know, because they're so tricky. And we keep got to go ever deeper inside. Slowly. And I don't care if you become a Buddhist. It's your choice, you know. It seems to me the things that I'm talking here, they're shared by so many people. I'm just using Buddhist approach to it. That's all. Speaking about it in my way of talking, you know. Like we talk, there's many methods, many different approaches to things, and we have to choose our own approaches. What else? Yeah.
Sometimes I think about non-attachment and the difference between non-attachment and detachment. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes, I think it's probably, I think non-attachment and detachment, you could sort of really argue mean the same thing, but that's a tricky word because often we misinterpret the result of giving up attachment means you become indifferent. Because detachment sounds, you know, very indifferent. And that can be dangerous. Because that's a very common misconception if we just give it a fairly superficial, if we look into this stuff in a fairly superficial way. So, you know, you're in a relationship and you start trying to give up attachment. And then you kind of, you know, you don't talk much. Oh, no, I'm not, I don't need to talk. I want to give up attachment to talk. No, I won't have any food today. No, I won't sleep with you today. I'm trying to become detached. Well, excuse me, you know. Well, then go off somewhere else and be detached. Thanks a lot. So it's, you could say, you know, in the beginning, when you first give up, say, alcohol or cigarettes, a very strong objective attachment, you've got to be cautious. You've got to keep out of the way of danger. You've got to protect yourself. And in a way, you've almost got to be detached from it. You need to be. But and the same here. There's got to be a time. It's a period. And it's a long way to get rid of attachment. But the real one, I'd say, is because we are in relationship with others, then it's good and optimistic to see that the less attached you are, the more kind you are. The less attached, the more generous. The less attached, the more loving. The less attached, the more forgiving. So that is, for me, really important to hear that that's the opposite. as opposed to like nothing, you know. That can be get dangerous. But we've got to be cautious. And so if you're really going to get, that's why I joke about not joking, the best way to get this is to give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Become a monk, take the vows, go to the mountains, get single point of concentration. Then you'll do it very quickly. And then you can come back down again and join human beings again and be pretty together, you know. But most of us will do it in our own environment with our people. Do you see? Yeah. So you, but you also could say, you also could say, in my experience at the chocolate cake, that, you know, you could say, when you're really quite advanced at this, you might prefer chocolate cake, you know, because that's just your style. But you've got enough, you've worked on your mind enough to be really controlled, and, you know, and you can say you're detached. I'm happy to enjoy chocolate, carrot cake as well. But you're working on your mind, you've been through a process. You notice it, oh! You notice you kind of slight disappointment, and then you go, it's okay, I can handle carrot cake. So that you could say you've got a balanced mind where you can turn on a dime quite easily. You understand? Because often what we can misinterpret as detachment is actually aversion. Oh, no, I don't want any sex. I'm detached. Oh, no, I don't want food. Oh, I don't want conversation. I don't want, you know, that's actually aversion, and it's quite, you have to be careful with that. Apathy, then that's the one of real, yeah, that's indifference. And that is not what the meaning of detachment is at all. It's either aversion or uncaring, and they're just two other delusions as well. So it's kind of tricky. Got to be skillful, you know. And the other one, too, for goodness sake, is to, you know, to get to the point where we actually have gone beyond detachment, you're practically already liberated by then. It's a highly advanced state. So so for most of us, it's a real full-on practice every day. Controlling the body, controlling the speech, not vomiting out our thoughts, you know, trying to be happy to get the carrot cake, shutting your mouth. I mean, it's a real struggle every day. And that's where we've got to learn to hear all the attachment and the dramas and the nonsense and not wish they'd all go away. That's often what happens. But learn to live with this rubbish and work with it every day. Make friends with your junk. You've got to have these roommates for a while. Your miles, you know, they're not going to leave. So don't wish they weren't there. Wish they weren't there, but, and work on it slowly. But meanwhile, make friends with that part of yourself instead of, because what happens with us, we start practicing. Then you start having aversion towards yourself and guilt. And I shouldn't be attached. And I shouldn't be this. That's a double trouble. Do you understand? Because it's going to be a while before we subdue this stuff, but we start where we are. Start with controlling the behavior. Start with stop vomiting out everything you feel. You know, that's pretty good already. Do you understand? What else? Yeah.
Hi.
Kim.
Oh. Is it on? Okay.
Where are you, sweetheart? Oh, there you go. Yes, yes, yes.
So you just talked about the difference between attachment and...
Please, like an ice cream. Make it really close to the
mouth. Okay, hi. So you just talked about the difference between attachment and detachment, and I was wondering how that applies to when you're not, like, when you're afraid of maybe getting into a relationship. Like, not the you idolize a person part of things, but how to handle, like, intimacy, essentially.
I understand, sweetheart. You know, I mean, we've all got a minefield in there. We've all got our own dramas and our hurts and our pains and our low self-esteems and our worries and our fears of being rejected. We've all got our own stuff. So the more we know our own stuff, the better. But then I think to have a relationship, I'm already not kidding or even being sarcastic, you've got to be very courageous. You've got to be prepared to learn. You've got to be prepared to see your mind every day. You've got to be prepared to have real humility and patience, because when you start getting close to people, you know, excuse me, I'm always so rude and things and... Maybe Australians are more blunt than Americans, I don't know. But, you know, if it's a boy you like and you start living together, I'm sorry, you're going to see him naked, you're going to hear, smell his farts, you know, really and truly. So then suddenly the bubble bursts. So then you really have to have practice humility and patience and kindness. So it's going to be attacking your mind very easily. It's much better if you live separately. Or you live your own separate rooms. You get dressed up nicely when you're going to be together. Because it's much harder to keep seeing a person so divine when you see their bad side, their smelly side, and their smelly breath at night and everything. I mean, it's just a simple example. I'm sorry, you know. So we've got to be ready to really work on it, not have the fantasy bubble. There's a full-on job you're involved in here, if you think it's what you really want, to have a relationship. So, because, you know, in the end, if we're trying to give up attachment and give up delusions, whether you're a nun like me or whether you do it in a relationship, our job is the same. You just choose your environment in which you do it. Do you see? It's not as if monks and nuns have special secret practices. Okay, we have a vow not to have sex. That's the only one. But lots of people are celibate these days. It doesn't matter. It's more that we choose the environment in which to look at our mind and give up attachment and give up the junk. And it is more intense in a relationship because it's more dangerous. But you've got to be brave and be prepared to risk attachment and to risk the dramas. But if you're both coming from a sincere place, then it'll be okay, you know, because you can't be perfect. So, if it is too dangerous, like with the alcohol, then you're back away from it. We've got to know our own mind, you know. I know, and there's no doubt, I joke about it, but I'm serious, the kind of person I am. There's absolutely no question the monastic way of life was the right choice for me. There's no way I wanted babies and living. Even when I was into having sex and drugs and rock and roll like crazy, or jazz actually, not rock and roll, really, I never had the thought to live with somebody. That would have been like in prison for me, you know. So we've all got different natures. But it was too intense. That environment was like being in a fire for me. So we have to choose what's right for us. We have to know what's right for us. Some people want babies and have wanted babies since they're born, and they're going to have babies. You know? So, you're in for it. It's a tough job. Babies, partners. The more we have a fantasy about it, the more devastating and sad and depressing and lonely and unhappy it is when it doesn't turn out the fantasy. And it can't be turning out to be the fantasy, because a fantasy is a fantasy. And then when there's more realism, it's a more genuine relationship, you know, and therefore less disappointment, less dramas. Do you see what I'm saying? And then you have to be courageous. I mean, in relationships, you know, it's always so heartbreaking when the person, you know, after 30 years has given up for a younger version. When in a relationship, we tend to think it's good to share every tiny atom of my being with this person, which is kind of maybe naive, you know. I don't know. I mean, do people think that in relationships? That's an ideal in a relationship, isn't it? That you want to share everything about yourself. There should be no secrets. Oh. I mean, maybe we've got to look at that, whether that's neediness to be approved of, or whether it's just, I mean, it's fascinating, that one, isn't it? I mean, lots of people have relationships and they live in separate houses and they just come together and go to the movies and love each other and go away again. I think that's very healthy. I mean, I'm not trying to be, you hear my point here? Okay, we've got to learn, whatever we do, as long as we keep learning from it, learning about our own mind, learning about our expectations, learning about our disappointments, learning to be forgiving and loving and kind. Because the closer you get, the more dangerous it is, and there's going to be the other dramas all coming, you know. So, be ready for it. But if on the other hand, you're talking about fear of it all, so fear of it, but still wanting it. Is that what you're saying? Fear of it, but also wanting it?
Not sure.
Okay, there you go. So, okay, that's where we have to be clear what is the right thing, not because the world says, not because they think, well, I should. I mean, in some cultures, even in our culture, even a while ago, it was considered you were weird if you didn't have a partner. Now it's kind of common. So this is where we have to be authentic. No matter what it is we want, we have to know what we want. Then you've got to decide if it's valid or not. I mean, you've got to know you want to kill your father if we want to kill your father. It doesn't mean you follow it. But the problem is we don't know what we want, and then before we know it, we've killed our father. Oops-a-daisy, what happened, you know? So we've got to know our own minds. And so we've got to have the courage also to look into what we want and then put it out there and look at it and then make our choices. That's the courage that's really necessary. Do you see?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, Kim.
Duplex.
I hear you talking a lot about the massive attachment we have to the judgment of others about ourselves, but I have at least as much, if not more, attachment to the judgment I have of myself, that I judge myself, often it's negative.
It is negative, period.
Okay.
It wouldn't be virtuous, because we don't tell ourselves good things about ourselves.
Right.
So, okay. But I think it's very linked to what we think is expected of us. The internalized daddy, mummy, God, It turns into that one. If we listen to the voices carefully, I think it's referring to what we've internalized, that what's expected, you know?
And it's very sneaky.
It is. Of course it's sneaky.
Yeah.
And that is, they're very linked, these ones. They're very, very, very linked, you know? It's true. I mean, there's thousands of voices. Attachment's got about a million different voices, a million different way of variations, you know. And this is a very, very, very common one, but that's the one you see of dissatisfaction, which is the energy of attachment, which is the one that I'm not enough, don't have enough, no matter what I do, no matter what I get, it is never enough. And we always fall to the default of no good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I say, 27 people can say nice things about you.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hungry to hear it, but we won't believe it. One person says one bad word, we run like a magnet, because that we believe totally, which proves that this, and this is the point about Kim, this is the point about ego. In the way Buddha talks about ego grasping and these neuroses, they are in the nature of delusion. They're not virtuous in any way possible. Virtue is interconnectedness. Virtue is light and spacious and no self-consciousness. When we're loving and kind, there's no self-consciousness. There's a connection with others. And it's only optimistic and it's only virtuous. The negative ones, it's not as if, see, when we are criticizing ourselves, it is only negative. And the only time we say anything good about ourselves is in a defensive, hurt way. Well, I'm not really like what they think anyway, sort of thing. I'm better than that. It's defensiveness, which is in reference to what we think others think. It's quite subtle. You're saying what's true. It's subtle. And they're so linked, all these voices. The irony of ego is it's self-hate. Is, as Lama Yeshe calls it, it's self-pity. It's kind of, it's addiction. It's an addiction. We'll just have it. It's habit. Born with it. And attachment is one of its main voices, which is the energy of attachment underneath is dissatisfaction, which is this one. Criticism. I'm not enough. So tricky to see how they all connect. Isn't it? Yes, Kim. Yes, Jim. Oh, yes, darling. Yes.
This is kind of on that same subject.
Yes.
I, too, was raised Catholic, and just as an example, a few days ago, a 93-year-old friend called me and said, I haven't seen you in so long, you don't stop over like you used to. Guilt. So then I go and I visit her, and I am light, and I'm spacious, and I know I bring her joy.
Uh-huh.
Then I leave, I come home, and I feel resentful.
Uh-huh. That's
so,
right.
So what
okay.
do I do?
Okay.
Do I not
right.
go see her unless
no,
I really...
Okay. Okay, okay.
That happens to me a lot.
I understand, Jackie. Well, first of all, I wouldn't blame the Catholics for that.
My mother? Can I blame my mother?
Or your Jewish mother? The Buddha would say that's just the way ego is. That's just the way ego is. What happens is, as soon as we point out a fault, like she did, she pointed out a fault, we immediately go, oh, I'm a bad person. Isn't it? Which is self-hate. It's just like you point out a fault in someone else and you say, oh, there's a bad person. So we see a bad thing out there, that person did something wrong, and then the conclusion we come to is they're a bad person. So you see something wrong you did in here, and we go, I'm a bad person. So that conclusion, that second thought, is the one that's called guilt. So it's not, we don't have to go there. The first thing a person says is, this person, she says to you, where have you been? So she was unhappy, she was sad. So if we're brave enough, this is a non-ego response. Well, she's absolutely right. It is a while since I've seen her. And let's look at the reason. I'm busy, but it's not really I'm busy because she's not that much fun to be around. It's a bit of a bore to get there. And I don't love her that much. We'd be very honest with ourselves, Jackie. Guilt is not taking responsibility. Guilt is like a child, we're all like it, who then feels offended because someone criticized me. So then out of guilt you go to see her, and then you're annoyed with her because you felt like she's manipulated you. All of that is a function of ego. So the better way to do it would be this. Hello, Mary, how are you? You're absolutely right, darling. It is a while, and I really apologize. And when you put the phone down, you think, well, this is absolutely true. She's right. And why? Because I don't like her that much. And she is a drag to be around because that's the truth. Right, Jackie? Well, then be honest with yourself. She.
I don't go see her.
What, Jackie? No, I haven't finished yet, Jackie. You haven't finished the story yet. We start with honesty. Guilt is not taking responsibility. That's where you take responsibility. Now, if she's just paranoid, and you really have been recently, but she just thinks it's a long time, then you'd be kind and humble and listen to her, and then you would apologize. You're absolutely right, Mary. I'm really sorry, darling. And when you put the phone down, you think, poor Mary, she's a bit paranoid. But the first one is, we go to guilt because that's what self-pity does. And that's our default mode, and that's ego, Jackie. And then you blame her. But you had the guilt. You went out of guilt, and then you blame her, and then you have resentment. This is ego, sweetheart, so we have to change the voices. So you first recognize you're absolutely right, Mary. I really apologize, Mary. I'm so sorry. And, of course, you're training yourself to be courageous. You're training yourself to be genuinely kind to this 93-year-old person. So you put the phone down and you think, okay, I'm going to go and see her. And then you decide, I want to go and see her. I want to go and see her. So then you give yourself an hour to go and see her. You spend that hour and you are hers for 100% for that hour. And then you come away and you are happy because you've chosen to take responsibility. You've spoken the truth. You didn't go. She's right. And it's because you've got aversion to her. She's not your dearest beloved friend. If she was your beloved friend, you go to see her every day. Fact, isn't it? Fact. And so you own whatever you do. You own it. That's what accountability is. Guilt is no accountability. Guilt is a child who likes to blame someone else. We're all like it. Join the club, darling. This is the way ego is. So to catch it. Do you see what I'm saying? So of course you go, but you choose to go out of kindness. Out of genuine kindness to her, you make an effort to go for her sake. The only time we mostly do anything is because it suits our attachment, and we think we're being kind. We have to stretch ourselves. Go to the sad old lady who's got nobody. Give her an hour. Love her for 100% for that hour. Do you understand?
Do I only go when I can go without feeling resentment?
You're missing the point completely, Jackie. You're missing the whole point, what I said.
It isn't necessarily even guilt sometimes, because sometimes I go even when she hasn't said anything.
Jackie, listen. There's two levels of practice. The first one is the wisdom wing, which is all this process of you hearing a person criticize you, you become offended, then you feel guilty. But the fact is, what I'm trying to say is the first step is you be honest to yourself, and you agree with her instead of guilt, which is, oh my God, I'm a bad person, and you feel, and this is where Kim's point. If we analyze guilt, someone's criticizing you, and we turn it against ourselves. She criticized you, and we don't want to be criticized. Then you feel guilt, which is this internalized criticism. Instead of this, you own the truth of it. You simply say, you're absolutely right, Mary. And when you put the phone down, you think it through. You say to Jimmy, well, you know what? She's absolutely right. I haven't been to see her. And why haven't I? Because I'm not attached to her. And it's an effort to go to see her. Mm-hmm. This is true. Is it true, Jackie?
I did think all that.
Good.
Well,
that's being truthful, and that is accountability. Then you what I'm trying to get at is this. Once you say that, the guilt is finished. Then you choose to go to see her, not because of guilt and shame, and not because she thinks you should and everything, and you get annoyed, you're still annoyed with her, but because you want to practice kindness. And practicing kindness is doing what attachment doesn't want to do. That's
and
what
I chose
really,
that.
Well, then where's the resentment coming from?
I didn't have the time to be there. So then my whole day
so you're
felt
rushing.
Very rushed.
Okay, so you didn't choose to really be there when you were there.
Oh, I was there, but I didn't.
But you just
I'm
said
not
you
good
were...
on time management, maybe.
What?
I didn't think I could. I thought I could get everything done that I needed to get done today and still have an hour for her. But I was wrong.
I don't understand what you're saying now. I don't get the point. You went to see her, right?
Right.
So what do you mean you didn't have an hour? You just made an hour.
I made an hour,
well,
but then I was very rushed for the rest of the day.
But you didn't need to be rushed. This is what I'm pointing about, just the choice.
Yes.
This is my point about choice, Jackie. This is my point about choice. You simply rearrange your priorities, but that's pushing yourself and guilt and pressure because I'm supposed to do this and supposed to do that. And that's all to do with what other people think of us as well. Real subtle, real deep in there. So you decide, you change your priorities. You put away that one, and I'm going to give her this hour, and I'm going to choose to do it without rushing because you are the one who's rushing. No one's making you rush.
You're right.
No one's making you not prioritize it. You decide you're going to do it, which means you stop this one, you change your appointments, and you do it with a happy mind. So in other words, the whole thing comes down every time to being accountable and in charge of our life and doing it, choosing to do it and then choosing to have a happy mind about doing it.
Thank you.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. It took a while.
Good, done. Perfect. Time to go home, really. Look, it's 10 to 9. Enough, isn't it? Any more questions? Yes. Hi, darling.
Hi, I have a quick question. What
a bit closer to the mic.
Sorry, okay. Sometimes there's a person we really love, and we see that this person is encountering some challenges, and we might have advices.
Sorry, challenges meaning they're having
in
a problem.
In life, yeah, it's a problem that we see it's recurrent. Of course, we are seeing these problems with our own eyes and our own attachments. But we wish you could say something, but we're not sure.
You mean the person's like an alcoholic and you want to help them?
Yes.
Okay, so what's the question?
Should we help?
Okay, okay. So, okay, okay. So, you have, okay, I understand. So you have the wish to help, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's called compassion.
Uh-huh.
That's called compassion. That's perfect. But compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. And what wisdom is the confidence that the person is ready for your advice and wants to hear it. And 90% of the time, when we give advice, they don't want to know. We stick our noses in where they don't belong because we mean well, but it's mixed with our own attachment. So the real one is to love them for who they are. Don't criticize them. Don't talk about them behind their back. Don't always think of them in those terms. Respect them. Love them. And then if and when a time comes when you are confident that they want your help, have asked for your help, or you're able to give it and they're ready for it, that's the time to do it. And that's real wisdom. And that takes a struggle. Because the trouble is, with our compassion is good, but our own attachment to the end result, our not liking their unhappiness, wishing they'd change, being distressed by it, that's our problem.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. That's a really important one.
Thank you.
Chuck the mic down. There we go. Down the end there, the gentleman in the corner. Then we can go home. 10 to 9. Hang your britches on the line.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to see if I understand you.
Okay.
And I need to be concrete. So I'm going to use this example.
Okay.
My beautiful wife, she goes to a conference, and she's away from me.
Your beautiful wife
goes to a
golf course and she's waiting for you.
No, I'm sorry. She goes to a conference.
A conference.
And she's, and I start to miss her. And I start to yearn for her.
When she's away from you, you
yes,
mean?
Yes.
She's gone away for a few days.
She's not warming my bed. She's
okay,
not,
darling.
She's not doing all sorts of things. And I miss her. Now, that to me, from what you said, is attachment.
I understand.
And if I could, rather than feel that, if I was happy because she's learning she's broadening her horizons.
That's right. Yeah.
That's real love.
That would be real love. Absolutely.
And so that's how I would discern
absolutely.
Love from.
And also, though, the bonus would be that you'd be very content on your own. So it's a different matter. Let's say there are certain jobs that she does that you need for her to do because you're not capable. That could be a practical problem. If you can't cook and she's the cook and you starve to death, that's just not appropriate. But you understand
my
point.
That's true.
So usually it's the emotional one and we love. And that's the tragedy. There's nothing wrong with loving somebody. It's wonderful to have our beloveds around us and see them and talk to them. But and this is where it sounds cruel, we don't see the depth of what is attachment. And the sign of its being attachment is what you're saying. Missing, feeling like there's a hole there when she's not there. That's the, which sounds so advanced. We can't even imagine being this way, but it's possible we can be. And to remember, we won't be indifferent like we're talking here. You'll be fully content and blissful and love, and you'll be full of love and compassion, and you'll be delighted when you see her, and it's okay if you don't. We can't imagine being this way, but it's possible. But real love would be delighting in her. Yes, exactly. Delighting for her that she's learning something. That's what love is. Definitely. Being happy for her. Yes. And then when she leaves you for a younger version, even then you'll be able to be happy for her. That's the real thing.
I am the older version.
Oh, they, okay. Okay. All right. Time to finish, don't you think? Enough food for thought. Food for thought, I hope. So I don't care if you become a Buddhist. That's your business. But our mind is ours. Our thoughts are ours. You know, we have to know ourselves. We have to identify what's going on in our own minds and have to have a delight in doing that so that we become this amazing person we can become. And then we can practice the compassion wing really well and be of benefit to others and have genuine love for others. But it's full-on hard work. Don't think it's not. So have courage. Have courage. Pull up your sleeves and jump in, you know, and learn from our experiences. Learn from our mistakes. Learn about ourselves and never give up. That's the key. Never give up. Kewa ji nyu du dag lama sangge drup gyur ne trowa chi kyang ma lu pa jayi sala kapa sho jam chob sem chog rin po che ma khe pa nam khe gyo chig khe pa nyam pa me pa yang gom ne gom du pa ba sho. All right, thank you, everybody. Thank you.
And we would like to thank our incredible sponsors who help make these teachings available. We thank John Castello, who dedicates for
Castello.
The... Castello.
When he answers the phone, he says, Castello. Don't you?
Thank you, John, for the long life of Venerable Rabina and all our other precious teachers, and Paul Hagwood. And I'd also like to do a quick advertisement. We have for sale in our bookstore a DVD called Chasing Buddha, which is all about Venerable Rabina's life and her work in prisons. And sales of the DVD benefit the Bodhicitta Trust, which benefits projects of our spiritual teacher Lama Zopa Rinpoche and the FPMT, and Venerable Rabina, and also Kadampa Center. So helps two ways. And Venerable Rabina is leading a pilgrimage to the holy sites of Nepal and India. These are the places of the major events in Buddha's life. It's an amazing trip. I've been on it, so I can speak to you about it if you have any questions. There are postcards for it in the lobby if you'd like more information. That'll be the end of this year, October and November. So please pick one up if you're interested.
I want to just let everyone know that there are still sponsorships available for the remaining teachings for Venerable Rabina. The sponsorships are just one way that we support the Kadampa Center here to have visiting teachers, as well as to have all our classes and offered on a donation basis here. So there are some envelopes down in your chairs that you can use for cash, check, credit card. We also have someone outside that can take your credit cards. So if you can do that, be sure to dedicate your merit while you're doing it and while you're making the donation. So thank you.
Are they specific amounts that when you say these